McGill Daily of the Daily.
I'm McGill Daily.
Hi, I'm calling from the McGill Daily. Can I ask you some questions?
This is a little bit diplomatic.
News. Can you design?
Could I see you for a second?
We're going to cap this.
News, can you dummy?
Did that story come in yet?
Editorial's in 5 minutes.
McGill Daily.
Unfit to print.
You're listening to Unfit to Print, a McGill Daily and CKUT News collaboration. This is Anya Sivajothi. Unfit to Print is a student-produced bi-weekly show that brings the latest of McGill and Montreal news. On today's program, we'll be hearing the speakers from the mass surveillance panel discussion following the Citizen Four screening that Amnesty International Concordia hosted last week. The panelists included Hilary Holmes, Amnesty International's campaigner on surveillance, security, and human rights, Gabriella Coleman, an anthropologist, academic, and author whose work focuses on hacker culture and online activism, Dr. Evan Light, the creator of the Snowden Archive in a Box, and Dominique Péchard, co-chair of the International Civil Liberties Monitoring Group. Following that, we'll be hearing from Kelly Scheider, who's a Res Project organizer, who will be speaking about the upcoming race and colonialism workshop that is being held as part of Res Project in January. But first, headlines. At an arts faculty meeting on November 24th, students and professors met to discuss Divest McGill's petition to the Board of Governors, which calls for divestment from the fossil fuels industry. After a lengthy discussion, the Assembly voted in favor of a motion to endorse Divest McGill's petition. Because the meeting did not meet quorum, the vote still has to be ratified online. A $3.4 million gift from a McGill alumnus has established the Yan P. Lin Center for the Study of Freedom and Global Orders in Ancient and Modern Worlds. The launch of the center took place on October 26th, and while the center has already organized lecture and activities, the official inaugural lecture by Harvard sociologist Orlando Patterson will take place on April 13th, 2016. Beginning in 2016, Montreal will be expanding its compost collection services. The municipality currently offers organic waste pickup to 8 boroughs and is planning to expand the service to all 19 boroughs by 2019, reaching more than two-thirds of all households in the city. On November 23rd, AXIM Unit 2, the Union of Invigilators at McGill University, held a General Assembly to discuss the ongoing bargaining process between the university and the union. The Invigilators Collective Agreement, ratified in May 2013, expired in April. This collective agreement had guaranteed wages of $10.65 per hour. Currently, Invigilators at McGill receive a base pay of $10.86 with a provincially mandated 4% vacation indemnity. In contrast, graduate student invigilators at the Université de Québec receive $19. Those at the Université de Québec à Montréal receive $19.74, and those at the Université de Montréal receive $17.43. On November 26th, McGill's Board of Governors convened to listen to a report from its committee to advise on matters of social responsibility and to consider the university's alleged violation of provincial Bill 100. The Board of Governors also discussed the reformatting of the university's annual key performance indicators and the state of philanthropic donations to the university. Board of Governor Chair Stuart Cobet reported on CAMSR's deliberations on Divest McGill's demand for a freeze on fossil fuel investments and informed the Board of Governors that CAMSR would not be able to recommend fulfilling this demand. On November 26th, three executives of the Student Society of McGill University, SMU, held an open forum in the SMU Clubs Lounge focused on community input on SMU's planned restructuring. The executives present were VP University Affairs, Chloe Rourke, VP Clubs and Services, Kimber Bialik, and VP Finance and Operations, Zachariah Houston, as their portfolios are the ones most affected by the restructuring. The event was attended by around 20 students. The restructuring is a response to a decade of expanding SMU activities, which has increased the burden on each individual executive to an unsustainable level. At the fall 2015 SMU General Assembly, SMU President Karim Ibrahim noted that there were multiple restructuring proposals, and the most extensively discussed being the addition of a seventh executive. That's it for headlines. If you'd like to find out more, please visit mcgilldaily.com/news. Now we'll be hearing the speakers who spoke at the mass surveillance panel discussion following the citizen force screening that Amnesty International Concordia held last week. The speakers were Hillary Holmes, Gabriella Coleman, Dr. Evan Light, and Dominique Peychaud.
Which is great in a lot of ways, but what he is fighting for is the right to be anonymous. And so what I want to talk a little bit about very briefly is the role of anonymity in political speech and political action, past and present. Because I do think it's under threat. A lot of people think that anonymity just produces the worst behavior in people. And in fact, I've also come across a number of people who think what Snowden has done is wonderful, but only because he did it not anonymously. And from my perspective, I would have valued what he did, whether he did it anonymously or not. So I'll just talk a little bit about whether citizens can be anonymous. I actually won't be talking too much about anonymous, even though that's what I've worked on quite a bit. But they are very interesting, so I just want to say one thing. I know in many of the examples I'm going to give, it tends to be very speech-based or a couple of individuals. With anonymous, we do have a global social movement that is predicated around the idea of anonymity. And it's very interesting because I was about to give a talk literally right before the first Snowden leak, and my kind of declaration was that privacy was dead and anonymous was the kind of party at the funeral of privacy. And then someone leaned over and said, there's been this huge leak, and they kind of described what it was, and I got really excited, and I scratched that from my talk. Because I do think we're in a very interesting moment where people are aware of these issues in a new way. So in the United States, the commitment to anonymous speech in particular has been highlighted by the Supreme Court. This was a 1995 case where someone was handing out anonymous pamphlets related to a local election. And the court ruled that this person had the right to give out pamphlets that were unsigned, that were signed anonymous. Anonymity is a shield from the tyranny of the majority. It thus exemplifies the purpose behind the Bill of Rights and the First Amendment, in particular to protect unpopular individuals from retaliation at the hands of an intolerant government. And perhaps the United States has this interesting tradition, unlike places like Brazil, actually, where anonymity is really not allowed, precisely because folks like the people who wrote the Federalist Papers, those who wrote the Constitution, actually published these papers, which kind of helped justify the Constitution pseudo-anonymously. So they signed the papers Publius as they published these pieces between 1787 in 1788.
Oops. Well, I want to thank Amnesty for organizing this projection, which is, I think, is a very important film because we owe a lot to Snowden for having raised public awareness. I mean, this was an issue with, like, surveillance was known to people like the civil rights organizations because the NSA practiced surveillance and so on was known, but getting public awareness was another matter, and Snowden has really made it a public issue. My slides are from a presentation, a workshop, which the Ligue des Droits et Libertés gives on surveillance and privacy, and many of the slides take up what you see in the film. The workshop is called I Have Nothing to Hide But Everything to Fear, because what you hear often is, well, I have nothing to hide, so I have nothing to fear, or I've done nothing wrong, so I have nothing to fear. And of course, this is completely beside the point. If you take examples of what can happen to ordinary people in the situation we now live. Of course, everything has been transformed in the last 20, 30 years. Those who are, maybe people in this audience don't know what before means. That means before mass data and internet and the possibility of stalking information and sharing it. But I'll take the example of what happened to Dr. Feldmar, who's a psychotherapist or in his 60s, maybe 70 now. And a few years ago, he was crossing the American border to visit his sons, and the border guard Googled his name and came up with an article he wrote in the 70s. Now, in the 70s, he decided that he would test LSD, which is a hallucinogen, which was popular at that time, and to see if it had a treatment value. And he wrote an article in a scientific review called Janus Head. And so the border guard came up with this, the American Border Service, and he said, well, you violated the American Illicit Substance Act, and so they arrested him. Felmar is a Canadian, okay? Well, all that leaves an electronic trace. So there's this mass of information which is gathered on everyone. And one thing that is new compared with previous police states, if you take East Germany, the Stasi, they had to do all the surveillance themselves to gather the information. But now we provide ourselves a vast amount of information to the private enterprise, and that is a wealth of information for surveillance. And some of this is done willingly because we get benefits. For example, fidelity cards are ways of knowing your consumer habits. And when you use these cards, well, you help draw a profile of your consumer habits. And of course, all these free services, okay, you can use Facebook, Skype, and so on. Well, they're not so free, because in order not to pay, what you in fact give is all the private information. Google keeps a track of all your searches, for example. So all this is a wealth of information which is accessible to the surveillance apparatus, which shouldn't be, but which is.
Thanks. So thanks. It's great to be here tonight. Every time I see Citizen 4, which now I've seen a lot, it reminds me of the trail I leave everywhere and how I've even incriminated myself. I work in Ottawa, but on Twitter I've already indicated I'm in Montreal, but just, you know, you pay for tickets, you book hotels, all that kind of thing. Everybody knows where I am right now. You know, so part of what people say to me sometimes, and, you know, we realize the irony, you know, technology is evil, you know. But from our perspective, technology itself is neutral. It's about how it's used and a law and policy that guides it. Oops, hang on. There we go. So for us as human rights workers, innovations in communications technology have done a lot of good for human rights. It's supported freedom of expression, it's fostered debate, it's enabled participation by people who never had that kind of access before. It's amplified the voices of human rights defenders that might be anonymous, not because they wanted to be anonymous, but because nobody cared, because they didn't really have a platform. And it's created some great new tools to document and expose human rights abuses. So there's a couple of images I have up on the screen. Amnesty started to use satellite technology a lot and work with people that help us to do that. So the image right here is actually, obviously it's before and after, you can see by, but in Nigeria, it's parts of Nigeria are where Boko Haram is operating. It's too dangerous for journalists to be there. It's too dangerous for human rights workers to be there. So we've been using satellite technology to show the extent of the devastation of some of the villages. And so we use imagery like that. We've also used it to document forced evictions and patterns like that, where you can, with the before and after imagery, you can document just how widespread these abuses are, often in situations where we can't be there ourselves. The other thing it's enabled, and that's the image on the other side, at Di Rovera. Donatella Rovera is one of our crisis researchers. It's enabled her to do sort of real-time reporting from border areas. That's actually, as you can see from the tweet, in a rather dangerous place, but she's brave enough to go there, and one of the things that helps keep her safe is her ability to live report on the ground. The other thing it's enabled us to do, and this is a little blurry when it's blown up that big, but Syria is a rather dangerous place to be as well. And so technology has allowed us to crowdsource reports of human rights violations. It's been wonderful on that level. But of course, at the same time, it's also enhanced the ability of governments to close down. Just as, you know, we've seen expansion of expression, governments have closed down that expression. They've controlled access to information by controlling disrupting digital technologies, blocking websites. as well as programs of mass surveillance and interception, all the lovely stuff that has been revealed in the film. State monopolies on mobile technologies and ISPs that tap right into systems have been really problematic. Ethiopia is actually one of the worst examples. Not enough people report on it, but they use that quite effectively to target journalists and critics and so on. And this tweet, you should look up this guy, he's a great human rights defender and activist in Bahrain. That tweet got him 6 months in jail, because some governments use that so much. What constitutes a threat is perceived very differently, and that's something we really need to think about when we talk about sort of whether or not we have things to hide, whether or not privacy is justified. Yeah, I mean, that was a public tweet, but a lot of the organizing that's done in countries like Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, there's a reason people need privacy. And it's quite legitimate to organize their activism. They're trying to organize for change in their societies in a context where insulting those who are in power is enough to get you imprisoned. So you need that space, as a number of the other panelists have mentioned, to talk to others about the change you want to see. And if you can't even have those conversations, how can you create that change?
Those were the panelists from the mass surveillance panel discussion following the Citizen 4 screening that occurred last week, hosted by Amnesty International Concordia. Now we'll be hearing an interview with Kelly Scheider, who is a Res Project organizer, and she'll be speaking about the upcoming Res Project workshop on race and colonialism.
So my name is Kelly Scheider, and I'm one of the three Res Project coordinators for this year. The other two are Sophia Salem and Kai O'Doherty.
Okay, and so recently, or maybe we can just start off by explaining what Res Project is, I guess, for those of us who haven't lived in Res or...
Absolutely. So Res Project is now a workshop series. And so the idea is that these are workshops to help people living in residence kind of talk about different issues that inevitably come up. And so they're introductory level workshops that all students in first year who live in Res receive. Right now, there's one that happens in September about gender, sexuality, and consent. And there's a second one in January about race and colonialism.
Mm-hmm. And how long have these workshops been running for?
Yeah, so the Res Project, Gender, Sexuality, and Consent is a workshop that's been running for about 12 years now, actually. So that one's the long-running one. And then there have been more workshops developed as kind of a need was identified and like as the role of the Res Project coordinator grew.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned another workshop happening in January related to race. So could you maybe explain why that one was brought up and why it was necessary to have that workshop?
Absolutely. So yeah, every year when feedback was collected from students in Res about what they thought about Res Project, this need came up all the time about wanting to talk about race and colonialism, especially from students of color and Indigenous students in Res. This was something identified a lot as something that like needed to be addressed just as much as gender, sexuality, and consent. So last year, there was finally the capacity kind of in the Res Life office to create this workshop. So it was written last year, and it was piloted last year for the first time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how is it organized, and is it mandatory for the students that are attending Res?
Yeah, so the way that it's organized is that facilitator pool includes floor fellows and upper year students, and then anyone else who's interested who lives in Montreal, really. And yeah, every student in Res receives it. It is both workshops are mandatory because it's really important that people be able to have these conversations with everyone that they're living with. And this really helps like foster, respect and communication in Res. So it's really important that everyone be there to have these conversations.
Mm-hmm. And some of the feedback, I guess, from previous Res workshops or project workshops, especially with the facilitators, is a concern over the training that they receive. And some of them have said in the past that they felt like it was rushed or they've received insufficient training for the workshops. And they were referring to the gender and consent workshop. But do you think that might occur in race, or how are you organizing it so that won't happen, I guess?
So with training, yeah, we have to train about 140 facilitators in order to make the workshop possible because there are 3,000 students living in Res. So it's a really, really big project. And so feedback from previous and current facilitators is something that we always take into account when developing the training for future semesters. So that's something that's really important to us. But yeah, it is a really big undertaking. And yeah, sometimes like things come up that are unexpected in workshops, but overall, like we really try to foster a space where we can talk about facilitation skills and content both. And we're always there also throughout workshop rollout in order to support people and support what comes up. But yeah, it's something that's evolving all the time, and definitely training changes each semester based on feedback.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that you like have a large pool, or like include a large pool for your facilitators, and you need a lot because there are 3,000 students in res every year. How do you select the facilitators for the workshops?
Yeah, so so the process, it's really open. Anyone who's interested in attending facilitation training is more than welcome, as long as they don't live in res themselves in first year, because that makes conflict of interest a little bit. But besides that, really anyone who's interested can get involved. And we really do see it as kind of an opportunity, both for students living in res, but also for facilitators to gain experience, which is why we really value the way that it works, where we have a training, but then also people learn a lot when they're actually facilitating the workshops themselves. So it's pretty open. Anyone can attend facilitation training. And then in terms of who actually ends up facilitating, it's really based on whoever is really ready to facilitate the workshops. Usually most people are pretty much there though, and so yeah, it's really a big undertaking that we just make sure to make ourselves as available as possible so that people are ready to facilitate if they want to after training.
Mm-hmm. And I guess just for your questionnaire, I guess relating to selecting facilitators, it mentioned that usually the facilitators are paired, so there's one person of color and a white facilitator. So what is the reasoning behind that, I guess, decision?
Yeah, so the reason that we do that is really kind of about ensuring the safety and comfort of the facilitators. So if the case is that a question comes up during the workshop that maybe makes the facilitator of color or the Indigenous facilitator feel uncomfortable, or it's just like, yeah, a question they would rather not have to deal with, then we have like a white co-facilitator who is ready and able, hopefully, to jump in and be able to address those questions. So kind of the idea behind it is really to kind of like divide the labor more evenly and have that emotional support of someone who isn't necessarily directly impacted by these issues, so that they can take on that. Also, because the workshop addresses race and colonialism, but also other things, there are just sections of the workshop that kind of make more sense to come from a facilitator of color, and some sections make more sense coming from a white facilitator. It just kind of really lends to the well-roundedness of the workshop and the way that it's received by first-year students.
Mm-hmm. Is there still time for people to get involved with the race workshop?
There is indeed. We are still looking for facilitators, and we would be really excited to see a lot of people sign up. And so, yeah, if you're interested in doing that, there are several ways you can get in touch, and then you would just fill out a survey, and that would be how you sign up for facilitation training. So you can either email us at resproject@residences.mcgill.ca. We also have a Facebook page. So either one of those, or if you really contact anyone in the Res Life office, they'll be able to forward it to us. There's also a call out floating around various email listservs and on Facebook that also includes the link. So if you find the link to the survey, or if you ask us for it, we'll give it to you. And then, yeah, training happens in January.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
That was Kelly Scheider, who's a Res Project organizer, speaking about the upcoming Res Project workshop on race and colonialism happening in January. And that brings us to the end of this edition of Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is the last one for this term, but we'll be back in January. And in the meantime, please check out our previous coverage and podcasts on mcgilldaily.com/podcast. Also, check out our joint issue that was just published this week at mcgilldaily.com, or pick up a print copy. Unfit to Print.